Hello and welcome to episode 54 of Random Encounter, the RPG fan podcast. I'm your host, Robert Steinman, Pale Robbie on the boards. Joining me today, we have the Emperor of Inaity.
My name's John. I like Cheetos.
Was that
Flaming Hot or regular? Both.
I was wondering, was that like a dig at Jeff Keighley? Like, what was that all about?
No, Jeff Keighley has Doritos.
Cheetos. My fault. All right, and then we also have the Music Man.
Steven Talus on the boards.
Okay. We have the person who hopefully came with a flame shield today because that Final Fantasy Lightning Returns trailer. Whew.
Yeah, it's not that good looking. I'm not going to defend it. It looks rough. I still want to play the game, don't get me wrong. But yeah, I'm Derek. I like things that Rob hates, and that's pretty much my function at this point, I think.
Yeah,
well, that's pretty much what everybody has, though. Everybody likes things that Rob hates.
Yep. Like ferrets, apparently. I can't even believe you.
I don't hate ferrets. I just think they're messy creatures.
Well, I don't even... No, go you on, wanna... please. Let's move on.
Okay. Then we have a newbie to the podcast. Why don't you introduce yourself, sir?
Hey, it's John Tucker. I am Cooker on the boards.
Hello.
Hey. And yes, I've been playing lots of Paper Mario and Persona 4 lately.
All right, so why don't we get started? It's been a long time since we had a podcast, and I apologize for that. Just very, very difficult time of the year, holiday season, blah, 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 blah. So why don't we start by talking a little bit about Paper Mario? So those that have played it, begin.
Ooh, I played like 5 minutes of it, got to a save point, and I haven't played it again.
Yeah, I probably played like 3-ish hours of it, but I think Tucker's going to be the one that likes it the most. Why don't you begin, Tux?
So I will say this, you know, a lot of us, I think, played Thousand Year Door. I loved that. I gave it an editor's choice when I reviewed it. That was an amazing game. And then we all saw there's a new Paper Mario coming out, and we were all so excited. And then we learned a little more about the gameplay and things and how it was going to be different. And we all got kind of disappointed and nervous. But I said, I'm going to play this thing anyway. And I will say that it definitely grew on me as I went through the game. The differences between it and the previous games, like not having an experience point system, not having the companions, I still felt like that was kind of a bummer all the way through. But the gameplay was just fun, and the puzzles were almost always fun. And it just, you know, the music was great. It looked really good. There's just so many things about it that that I thought really worked that I kind of was able to forgive it for not being its older brother.
I can definitely agree with you about the music. I feel like in my somewhat limited time I've played the game, the music is the thing that actually stands out to me the most, which is surprising because I think the last time I really played a Mario game and I was like, oh, this music is great, was Mario RPG. Because usually, I think I don't like the new style, the new Super Mario Brothers games. I really don't like the musical. I don't like really anything about those, to be honest. The Wii U one's pretty fun. But sorry. What? Yeah, I don't really. I think they're generic and uninspired and incredibly derivative. But anyway, Paper Mario Sticker Star has some...
I actually have to disagree with you both.
Pretty good music. Yeah? Go on, Steven. Tell us.
I actually, when I've played a Sticker Star and then I've listened to rips of the soundtrack from the rest of it, I actually think it's the weakest in the Paper Mario series, because Thousand Year Door has a fantastic soundtrack. And I think actually Paper Mario 1 and 2, not Paper Mario, Mario and Luigi 1 and 3 have way better music and way more memorable music.
Well, I haven't even listened to the soundtracks for any of the Paper Mario games in a long time. I honestly don't think I've even listened to them outside of when I actually played them. So maybe that's just my... You know, it's just subjective based on how long it's been since I played the others. But
and I don't know if I could say better or worse than the previous games. I just think it's really good.
Yeah, I think it definitely has the same spirit as the other Mario games. I guess I'm just spoiled because the battle theme in Thousand Year Door was so good, and the one in Sticker Star, honestly, I find just to be a little too heavy on the, I don't know, the whimsy.
Well, maybe I didn't mind it because I tried to avoid combat most of the time. I was like, you know, I got lots of money. I got an album full of nice stickers. Why am I going to use them up on enemies? But I have to say, when I finished, my wife picked up the game and she started playing it, and she's playing it totally the opposite of me. She like she looks for everybody she can fight and fights them. And she still has a giant album full of nice stickers. She has tons and tons of money. And the thing that she really hates about it is the platforming. She says she feels like that does not belong in this game because that's not the kind of game it is. And I can't say I disagree with her.
Like okay. I haven't played a whole great deal of Sticker Star, but I played a lot of Super Paper Mario for the Wii, which not really an RPG, which is why you didn't see coverage of it on RPG Fan. And that was a game where like the platforming fit because it was kind of the focus. And even just in like the little beginning area, I got really angry at a lot of the platforming. Like it's when your character is 2D and you need to do 3D platforming. That sucks.
Yeah, like he's flat, so it's really difficult to tell, you know, where do you position a flat sprite.
Yeah, it just totally screws with my depth perception.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that more so than the platforming, though, like the combat is probably the most controversial part of that game, just because, or rather, like your impetus for getting into combat, because it's kind of like your choices are get into a fight and then use stickers and get nothing but a couple coins out of it, or save the stickers and avoid combat. And I feel like that was sort of a weird design decision. I don't know if I should say bad, but it's just it's unusual that a game that focuses on its combat would sort of tell you, hey, you know, or sort of imply that it's smarter to avoid fighting.
Impression I kind of got was that, you know, for this Paper Mario, since it was handheld, Nintendo tends to have that philosophy of if it's handheld, you should be able to play it in short bursts. And that a lot of the game, like with the level structure and all that, it seems like that's how they have it set up. So that way you can sit down on the train, finish a level, and then bounce.
Can I just back up one quick second? Because I played Paper Mario Thousand Year Door, so I understand that combat system, like the time button presses and whatnot. Can we just maybe explain to the listeners real quick, like, what's the big difference? You guys started throwing around stickers and stuff, and I was like, stickers? What's going on?
That's a good point. So in this game, it's turn-based like Thousand Year Door was. You still have some of the timing things, like when you use a jump attack, if you hit A at the right time, you're going to bounce on the enemy and hit him again. In fact, you know, usually you can do it several times and hit him several times. But the difference is that you don't just have, you know, any attack you want available to you. You don't have the, like, sort of SP system with the, you know, sort of Mario mana. Instead, as you walk around the levels, the question mark blocks that you see, when you hit them, you may get a sticker out of them. When you walk around the levels, you'll see on the walls of the environments stickers, and you can peel those off, and they all go into a little album of stickers that comprise the set of attacks that you can do at that moment. You start off with just a couple of pages in your album, but then as you go throughout the game, you get more and more pages. I think you end up with 8 or 9 pages by the end of the game, which is definitely more than enough. And then the other thing that comes into play with attacks is that as you go through the game, there are certain objects that are, you know, very obviously like 3D kind of things in this paper world. The one that they showed in like the trailers and other things was a fan. You pick up the fan, and then you can turn the fan into a sticker that, you know, does massive damage, or in some cases the sticker can, the thing stickers like that can solve puzzles and stuff like that. So if you were to run out of stickers, well, then you wouldn't be able to make any attacks. You just have to run away from whatever fight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is sort of unusual, I think. I would have liked it better if there was maybe a default attack, like just a weak jump, and then all the stickers were your extra attacks. Even though in my limited playtime, like I said, I've never run out of stickers, and I feel like I've never even gotten close. So it just depends on how many fights you're doing. But again, that ties into the whole, like, if you want to keep a healthy stock of stickers, just avoid the fights. So
now,
go ahead, Joe.
Now, I understand this game has like a rather distinct lack of a level up system. Like there's no real focus on statistics. Can you kind of go into that?
Yeah. So you have HP. Enemies have HP. But other than that, like that's really the number in the game is just HP and, you know, how many HP an attack takes away from somebody when you use it. But the stickers all come, well, I shouldn't say all, but most of the stickers come in various flavors, like a really weak jump that's it's like a boot with a Band-Aid across it looking sticker, a regular jump, and then there's flashier and flashier types of stickers as you move through the game. You start to get more of those where, like, if you're in the first world or two, you're picking up busted boots and regular boots all the time. But then as you get into, say, the fourth world, you're seeing almost exclusively shiny ones, and then some even better ones thrown in there. And the variety of stickers that becomes available to you in the environments and in the shop as well grows. So in a way, and then, like I said, you get more pages for your album. So in a way, you get more moves available to you throughout the game, but it's not through that traditional leveling up and, you know, putting points into things or anything like that.
All right, cool. I'll let Steven ask his question now.
Well, I was going to say, just, I think what rubs me the wrong way about that sticker thing is it's kind of like why I've never really dug on roguelike games. I just don't like the idea that all of my progress on the character is tied to an item that I can lose. It was the same reason I didn't like Mario & Luigi 2, because rather than learning special attacks, you got items that, you know, they worked like the special attacks, but it's like, oh, you yourself aren't getting any better. You're just finding better stuff. And I mean, just for me, I know not everyone feels that way, obviously, but
I do, actually.
It just makes me feel like I'm not making any real progress. It's just like, oh, I happen to find something better, which means I'm better today.
Yeah, I find that even if there's just some incredibly minimal, you just sort of want a way to measure the progress that you've made with your character or within the game. And a game that's just saying, you know, your character is always level one or basic, and then your equipment is the only thing that changes. I think that sort of, it gives you a sense of impermanence as far as your progress. Like I said, you get stuff and it's like, well, I could lose this at any given time or whatever the case may be. So I don't know, this is a weird analogy, I guess, but I always felt that way about Monster Rancher growing up. Like, I don't know if you guys have played any of the Monster Rancher games, but your monsters are basically like your character, and then they die after a certain amount of time. But as you go through the game, like, you can upgrade your farm or whatever. And so just having that as like a way to make yourself better, like, you know, you upgrade your farm and then every monster has some, you know, some more advantages from the beginning, that sort of thing. I think that every game, maybe not every game, it's tough to say that, but I think it makes a bigger difference when games have sort of like a statistical backbone, if that makes any sense, whereas Paper Mario sort of lacks anything of that nature.
Well, I think the whole statistical backbone thing is important to gaming as a whole in modern gaming, because you look at every single game in the history of, I don't know, the Xbox 360, and it's got some kind of RPG elements to it. Like, it's not like Contra, where the Contra guy might pick up, you know, Spreadshot, and that was his, you know, the extent of his leveling up. You know, Batman gets bat things.
Not to be combative with you, John, but what about like Halo?
Well, even Halo has experience these days.
Oh yeah, that's true. They did put it in an experience system, didn't they? Okay, well, there you go. Well, I think that's also like we started seeing that sort of development of characters with Devil May Cry. It's like the first big 3D action game, which is like you would upgrade Dante, you would get new moves, and that's because I think people like to feel stronger. I think there's a real sense, at least one of the reasons I really like playing games, is this feeling of getting stronger, of getting better, not only with my own gaming abilities with the game, not only with my abilities to, like, hey, I can get through the last level of Super Mario Brothers where before I couldn't, but also the fact that, well, now I also have all this new stuff that comes along with it. So striking that balance between the player getting better, but at the same time opening up new things for you to do and making your character feel stronger, I think that's really hard. And a lot of games just don't get it right. They go one way or the other too far, and it can become obnoxious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's, and I, you know, I think that some people do like having it to one extreme. Like a lot of roguelikes, you have, oh, when you die, you lose everything. So for the player, it really is just, oh, well, you found good stuff, but it was, you know, it's all your skill there. Whereas you have like really hardcore RPG where it's like, you know, oh, well, your numbers are low, you're dead. Doesn't matter how good you are.
I would agree.
Yeah.
I think we've exhausted that topic a bit. Is there anything else that you guys wanted to talk about with Paper Mario?
I was just going to say one thing with, I don't remember who said it about playing games in short bursts. Rob, I think maybe it was you.
No,
anyway,
it was John. Oh, that was
okay, so one thing that about this game is with that level system, I think a lot of people were nervous about it. And I think that's really what the focus is in terms of having the world or having the game broken up into little worlds, little levels, is that when you finish a level off, you're done for now. You can, you know, put it on standby, go away. Every time you finish a level or even just leave the level, if you walk back out the front door, as it were, the game saves your progress. So you definitely can see that aspect of it, that it's designed to be a mobile game that people would play for the few minutes they have.
To bounce off that real quick, have you guys ever gone back and played like an older game? Like right now I'm not to try to pimp Okami HD too much. It's not a game we covered, but I'm playing Okami HD. I'm absolutely loving it. I love this game. I'm remembering why I liked it. And then I get to the save system, and I'm remembering that in order to save in this game, there's almost no checkpoints. They do put checkpoints right before boss fights so that you don't have to replay those sections. But if I want to save in this game, I have to actively seek out a save point. And maybe I've just been playing PC games way too much lately. But the fact that I can't save anywhere is really bothering me. And it's actively making me like question whether I want to pick it up, because it's almost like now, as John and as Tucker is saying right now, with a mobile game, you can like close it. You have a good like save feature. But with like Okami, now if I want to play this, I have to dedicate some time to it because I might not be able to find a save point for a while.
It's going to hold you hostage.
Yeah, and I think that's just as you've moved more into the modern age of stuff, a lot of people have a lot less patience for, you know, Final Fantasy style. Where's the next spinning floating crystal thing so I can save? Like, I mean, that was what was driving me nuts about The Walking Dead, which, not to start talking about that again, but you know, it's like I'd like to make a save here so that way I can, you know, say something different in this conversation and then go back. And then it's like, well, no, you can just go ahead and redo the entire chapter.
Yeah, I agree. Walking Dead was one of the worst examples of it this year, where like I didn't realize that the game wasn't saving one time, and I had to replay a 20-minute section, and I kept looking in the upper right-hand corner for the little like save blip, and I'm like, oh, okay, now I can take a break, and that it's like it is holding me hostage. This game is not letting me go.
Help!
Help! So overall, are we disappointed with Sticker Star, or are we okay with it?
I think Tucker likes it, right?
Yeah, I thought that, you know, when all was said and done, it was a really good game. It was not as amazing, you know, as awesome as Thousand Year Door, but neither was it, you know, all crappy and bad like we feared it might be.
I gotta replay Thousand Year Door. I got very far in it, and then I don't know what it was, but something wasn't clicking. Like I liked the combat. I really liked the writing, actually. I thought it was, mm-hmm. you know, kind of hip and fun, but I think maybe it was just like it. Sometimes a game just doesn't G up with you, and I don't know what it was. Just didn't do it.
The vibe I get from Sticker Star is kind of the same thing from Super Mario. Like, I enjoyed that game. It was good. The whole time I was playing, I was going, man, it'd be really cool if this was just like Thousand Year Door. But when I finished it, I still felt like, oh, yeah, that was pretty fun.
Oh. I don't really love Sticker Star. I hate to be... It's unusual when I'm the dissenting voice, like the negative person, but I don't want to say it's a bad game, and by no means should Tucker, you know, feel any shame or, you know, feel like he's in the wrong.
Shame.
Well, if anybody should feel shame,
to feel shame for,
it's always Rob that it's should true. Feel shame. But, you know, it's a perfectly fine game. I just think it doesn't mesh with me right now. And it just, I don't know. It's something about it just doesn't suit my taste, but I can see why other people like it. I think it's an okay game. That's it.
Okay.
Hey, let's talk about some dice.
Hey, I'm rolling them right now, actually.
The Battlefield Company?
Yeah, I'm so confused right now. We can't talk about Battlefront. I mean, it has a level-up system, but it's not an RPG.
Battlefront was made by a different company, just so you know.
It was cool, though.
Oh, for God. Touché, John. Touché. All right, so this is Crimson Shroud, eh? This is the same dude who made Final Fantasy XII, Final Fantasy Tactics, Vagrant Story. How awesome is it?
Considering that the game costs $8, it's amazing.
It's unexpectedly amazing, I'd say.
It's $8?
When you start it up, dude, it's a question of, like, when you buy that game, you're thinking, oh, I'm going to get some cool little mini game. No, you're getting a full-blown RPG with, like, crazy good production values, because when they made it in Japan, it was part of that 4-pack from Level 5. What was it, Guild 1? And the production value on it is ridiculous. I mean, there's no animation on the characters because of how the game is structured. I'll let somebody else say that. But it's like a two-disc soundtrack and like really nice graphics, awesome writing. You know, it's pretty solid.
All right, whoa. Back up even further.
It's so good. We love it. We're going to play it.
Back up. Where do I buy this game? If you say 3DS, I'm going to kill myself.
3DS. It is. It is on the 3DS eShop.
Oh, for...
Rob?
I'm poor!
Okay.
So...
It was $5. It was $5 on Steam.
Well, this game is $8.
But I need a 3DS.
The 3DS costs less than your video card.
Cancel your wedding.
Oh, yeah. Okay, you can tell her that.
Hey, if you did, you could go to E3.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Rob's like, no, seriously, guys, I'm going to get in trouble. Stop.
All right, let's take a step back. So Crimson Shroud is essentially what would happen if you took you playing Dungeons & Dragons with your friends and putting it into a video game. Now, I say that and you're like, well, John, what about like Neverwinter Nights or Baldur's Gate or any of those games? Isn't that just like it? And to that, I say no. No, it's not. Whereas those games kind of, they take the essence of the Dungeons & Dragons combat system. They're really set up like computer RPGs. Whereas this game, it's almost like being walked through a story by your dungeon master. You know, there's no animation in the game, with the exception of your little miniature figures jumping up and turning, but they're miniatures. Like, literally, they have the same pose throughout the entire game.
Yeah, like the little plastic base. They're literally the figures that you'd use in a tabletop game.
But it's, you know, it's like the dungeon match. Oh, you enter a dark, a dank room with, you know, whatever lining the walls. It's like being walked through a Dungeons & Dragons game. And it's really cool. Like, I can't get over the fact that I paid, you know, $8 for this and, you know, $60 for Darksiders 2.
Oh, why did you have to bring that game up
this
again?
This is one of those games where creativity trumps its production values by, you know, a long shot, just because even with like the character models not being that impressive, I mean, they're okay, but it's all about the writing, the atmosphere, the presentation, the UI, like everything about it just sort of immerses you into that sort of, like, you know, that tabletop RPG feeling.
Yeah, what I really dug was when I first started, because first of all, the miniatures look cool. Like, they're well designed. Like, they don't have any animation, but, like, you know, they look nice. But the whole world is set up like those little, you know, I don't know what you would call it, but you set up a dungeon in Dungeons and Dragons.
Like, it's like a mini map.
Fences and like mountains and stuff. Yeah, and it looks funny because everything is like only about waist high on your characters, like the, you know, the walls and fences, and you can see over everything. So it literally looks like you're looking down at a board.
Yeah, I dig the atmosphere, and what's great is the combat's good too. And it's all here's where Roz can be like, oh, maybe I don't want this game now. Everything is dice based.
Done. I'm muting myself.
So it really is, and when I say it's dice based, it's not like the computer does dice rolls in the background. It's like, oh, you need to roll a 13, and then on the bottom screen it shows like a group of polyhedral dice. So you might have like, okay, you need to roll a 13. You get 2d10 plus d6 plus d4, and you roll.
I'm just having flashbacks to high school and me getting so pissed off when, like, I don't mean to cut you off, but we had such a big Dungeons and Dragons group. And, you know, when you have a really big map and too many monsters and too many players, you could be waiting for your turn for like 20 minutes. And I would get to my turn and they would be like, all right, what is Rob the Thief going to do? Okay, I'm going to try to stab this orc. And you missed.
Yeah.
Okay, well, moving on.
So actually, the one thing that this game does very well is there's three characters in your party. And no matter how many other monsters you're fighting, like you might get into a combat with six, you only fight three in a time. So you kill one monster, it goes, oh, that monster is dead. And then it drops the next monster into the battle. So you're never stuck, and you're never going to get your destroyed by this party of orcs. Because, you know, you have to heal on a regular basis, you know. An orc might hit you, or a goblin. I don't know if they're or orcs, I don't remember.
Goblins.
But a goblin might hit you for, you know, 80 damage, and your character only has 300 hit points. So it's so far it's been very balanced. I haven't beaten the game yet. But I have to say I have a significant enjoyment out of it, and it really just does feel like a throwback to Dungeons and Dragons. And I guess if you didn't have a crappy Dungeons and Dragons experience like Rob did, you'd like it.
You know what I think what it does really well is it melds like the really Western style of like you're actually rolling dice. It's, you know, you're in dank catacombs with these like semi-realistic enemies like skeletons and minotaurs. And then it blends that with sort of the JRPG like menu system and straightforwardness of the story. And I think it does a really good job because, you know, you guys know me as sort of like the JRPG guy. And it's not because I don't like anything Western by any means. It's just because I just find that, like, most of the time when I try Western stuff, it doesn't appeal to me as much. But this does an incredibly good job. It's sort of, to me, it's sort of like it introduces me into a D&D sort of thing. Like, I've only ever played one campaign of D&D in my life, and it lasted, like, three games before everybody got fed up. But, and I wish that, you know, I wish that I had played more. But this is a really neat sort of in-between, and it's virtual. So it's not like I have to plan to get together with people and everything. But it's cool. I really like the way that it meshes the two styles.
And let me just have a real quick, Steven, and I'll let you in. Yeah. The game systems are relatively simplified too. All of your skills and everything are based on the items that you wield. So there's no levels. It's just when you win a battle, you get a certain number of victory points, or I forget what they're called. They're not called victory points.
And barter points.
What was that?
Barter points.
Yeah, barter points. And they're like, okay, here's all the potential loot that these monsters can drop. They each have point values and say, okay, I want to use this many barter points on these items. And you also get throughout the battles, you get bonus dice, and you can use those if like, oh, God, you know, this guy's almost dead. Let me put some bonus dice on there, make sure I kill him. But you can also turn those bonus dice into barter points. But really, it's not like Baldur's Gate where you sit down and it's like create your character, and it's like, okay, which feats do you want, and it gives you a list of like 80 feats, and you're like, do I want sword and shield specialization level 2, or do I want to take both sword and shield and sword and, or, you know, two swords, or do I want to take, you know,
short sword, long sword, bastard sword?
Yeah, it's really much more streamlined, which puts it in line with kind of its Japanese core. That's really what I wanted to say. I'll let Steven go.
Yeah, well, I agree with what you guys have said, too. And I think what I really like about it, aside from that stuff, is, I mean, it's pretty much Yasumi Matsuno's pet project. Like, they were like, yeah, make whatever you want. And he, you know, it's just, if you liked, you know, the world design and the writing and Vagrant Story, Final Fantasy XII, Tactics, that sort of thing, it's just more of that really awesome quality, just very detailed, kind of like European fantasy. And it's just, it has, like Derek said, it really does feel like a great combination of like a Japanese style RPG with like Western design aesthetics and like the dicey stuff. And I actually really like the bonus dice thing, because that's sort of like a video gamey addition to it, but it makes it flow a lot better. Like, you know, oh, you failed this roll, well, I threw a bonus die. And so, no, it didn't.
Yeah, the World of Darkness role-playing game, that tabletop role-playing game, has always done that sort of thing where you can spend willpower points in order to add to a dice pool. And I really like that kind of system because now you're adding a layer of strategy. And apparently, if you're a bad dice roller like me, that can help out a little bit. I really just hated the binary nature of D&D of just like, well, you have to get this magic number, and if you don't, then you miss. No amount of good storytelling or mechanics can get you past you have to get this number.
Well, I have no problem with the this is your victory number. I actually really liked the game system from Alternity, which was one of TSR's last products before they were purchased by Wizards of the Coast. But its dice system was scaled by dice. So instead of, like, in Dungeons & Dragons, it would be D20 plus 1, D20 plus 2, D20 plus 3. It was like, okay, you get D20 plus D4, D20 minus D6, D20 plus 3D20, or whatever, and it would scale the difficulty that way. So that, theoretically, you could fail at something easy, or you could be awesome at something, you know, difficult. But that's neither here nor there.
Correct me if I'm wrong, I've only played a limited amount of tabletop stuff, but the barter point thing is kind of set up like I played Warhammer Black Crusade with some friends, and that was like, when you get items, you have a certain number of points with which to pick items. Is that pretty much what they were going for with barter points? Or is
you
that...
know what? I haven't played a whole lot of miniature stuff. I know that with miniatures, you build your army with a certain number of points.
Hmm. Okay. But yeah. Crimson Shroud. It's a cool game.
And this also... is what happens when you roll dice. This is what it sounds like. That's all.
In case you didn't hear, that was the soundtrack by Hitoshi Sakimoto, which is a very,
and
very good one.
Boss. It's boss as hell.
If you like...
So I think pretty much what we've come down to is if you own a 3DS and you can connect to the internet and you have $8, and chances are listening to this podcast, you have all of those things, you should be downloading and playing this game.
Put it on iOS.
So Rob, this is I don't want to derail us too much, but I've actually been thinking back to a couple of years to a game that I reviewed on iOS for us. It's called Rhymelands, Hammer of Thor. It was pretty good at the time. They've patched it up since then, and it's better than it was when I reviewed it. But its combat is also dice-based. It's not exactly the same kind of gameplay as you guys are talking about with this. It's more of a straight-up turn-based RPG thing where, you know, you're rolling dice, and as you go through the game, you know, depending on the ways that you choose to level up, you get more dice or whatever else. It looks like it's $5 right now. I don't know. Read the review. Check it out. Maybe that would be something you'd be interested in.
Speaking of iOS, what did they do? They put maybe this will get us into news, but they put Final Fantasy VII on iOS, and how much does Square Enix want
seven?
For it?
You mean four?
Seven, four.
Was it four?
Okay. Yeah. Put any price and, on. People would be like, I must have it.
So what did they price Final Fantasy IV at?
I don't know, like $17.99. That's what they priced everything.
I think it was like
$15.99.
My God.
Now, keep in mind, Rob, if you go to the DS and want to buy that, it's going to cost you $25-$30.
I mean, I'm
not a big fan of how they price their stuff on iOS either, but that, and you're getting into relative value of stuff. Like, is the game suddenly worth less money because it's on iOS?
No, I get that, but I'm just... I'm going to hold off. Let's make the last news story Lightning Returns, because I just want to tear Square Enix a new one today.
Oh, but you know, I don't know if you wanted to talk about it at all, but I guess we could just touch on the fact that when they announced the iOS port of FF4, they did mention at the end of the trailer it teased, it said, and coming soon, the mobile revolution begins or something, you know, Square Enix-y like that. And it showed the FF5 logo and it said, and more. Mm-hmm. So... I would imagine that means that they're coming to iOS, but if they did any kind of remake of FF5 or 6 for 3DS or Vita, I'd probably die.
Yeah, that'd be pretty fantastic. 5 and
you know
6.
What? Really? Final Fantasy 6 is on my list of games like Phantasy Star 4 that I really don't want to see remade.
I am right there with John. I really don't want them screwing with that game.
I have lots of games.
Really good job with 4, don't you think?
No.
The PSP remake of 4 is good, I think. I don't like the DS and iOS one.
Like, I have no problem with enhanced ports. Like, the GBA version of Final Fantasy 6 was great. But, like, I go and I think of like, what they were trying to do with the Sega Ages Generation 4, which luckily never came out. And it just, with Phantasy Star 4, the storytelling in that game was so very much tied to the technology level that if you tried to do it with modern technology, you would break it.
I agree.
I agree with that in terms of Phantasy Star 4. The graphic novel things, at the time, it wasn't anything else like that. It was awesome. I mean, there was Phantasy Star 2 and 3, but 4 really turned it into kind of a, you know, considering all you had were sprites, you suddenly had these characters with, like, expressions and stuff, and it was really cool. And I do think if you remade that now in 3D, you'd end up with generic anime RPG.
That's exactly what I'm worried about. It's very similar to film for me. I think there's just some things you don't want to go back to. It's just leave them alone.
Red Dawn?
Yeah, like Red Dawn or Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. There are just some things you because it's so ingrained. Like, do we want to see a reboot of The Dark Knight with another Joker? Like that, sure. That performance is going to be held up to a huge high standard. And Final Fantasy VI,
but that's exactly what everybody said after the original Batman. People went into The Dark Knight going, "Oh, well, he'll never be as good as the Joker from 1989."
Those
Batman.
People were
and then everyone was like, "Oh, Heath Ledger's the greatest Joker of all time."
I'm just saying that Final Fantasy VI to me is it's one of those games that I put up on a pedestal and I go, okay, for everything came together, story, gameplay, graphics, technical ability on the Super Nintendo, everything came together to make this really, really special RPG. If you try to redo it, I just feel like it's not going to be the same. The planets just align. It's like I keep doing movie analogies, but like think of Godfather 2.
And you love referencing The Godfather.
I do because it just trumps everything. In Godfather 2, originally Marlon Brando was supposed to come back for the flashback scene at the end of the film with the whole Corleone family together. He was supposed to be in that scene, and they got into a pissing contest in the production studio, and so he didn't come in. And because he's not in the scene is actually better because now you hear the door open in the background and everybody goes to him as their dad. And now he's been elevated to a level. Because he wasn't in the scene, it's now become better. The limitations on Final Fantasy VI for the time made it a better game in my eye. I mean, think about when Terra's parents get together. Spoiler. The way they handle that scene is kind of hokey and quirky, but it's also a clever way to introduce her character and the relationship of her parents. Now, today, imagine what they would do.
Well, I think if I can understand where you're coming from. I think it depends on the style in which they handle it. Like if they tried to go for more of like the FF4 DS and iOS style and with the little character models and all that, like the voice acting and all that, I don't know how that would go. If they redid it, if they just sort of HD-ified it and did it like the FF4 PSP remake, I think that was like about as good of a remake as it could have gotten.
So what you're saying is just like make it pretty.
I guess I disagree with you. Sorry, go ahead.
No, that's about it. I mean, I just feel it depends on the way they handle it, really. I mean, who can say? It depends on the way that they render it and do all of that and the way that they want to treat some of those scenes. I think that no matter what, with something like Final Fantasy VI that's held in such high esteem, I mean, it's my favorite Final Fantasy as well as the favorite of many other people.
Right here.
It's going to be impossible to please everybody with the way that they redo it. So that's why doing a remake is treading incredibly dangerous territory. But I also think that it has the potential to be good. I'm not going to rule it out right away.
I don't know. I guess I disagree with you guys because I thought the Final Fantasy IV remake on DS was better than the original because I never really got. I mean, I tried to beat that game like 5 or 6 times, and you know, I got pretty far. I liked it. It was Final Fantasy.
You know, with Final Fantasy IV, I run into the place where I really don't like Final Fantasy IV, and I think
that's my thing too.
I think what it comes down to is I didn't play Final Fantasy IV when it first came out. I had a Genesis. I didn't have a Super Nintendo until the very end of its life cycle. And I played Chrono Trigger then, and Chrono Trigger was amazing. Same with Final Fantasy VI. But I play Final Fantasy IV now, and it feels very childish, very amateurish. And I feel like because I lack kind of that nostalgia factor for it, I don't feel like it's very good.
It feels like an RPG Maker game, which I mean, you know, I guess you'd have to say the opposite. RPG Maker games feel like Final Fantasy IV, but I don't have any nostalgia for it either. And I think that's why when I played the remake, I said, wow, this is, you know, they've rebalance the combat. It's more challenging. I like the I don't remember what they called it, but the stones you could get that would give you other characters who had left abilities, so you had more customization open to you.
The augments.
Yeah, the augments. And I feel like when that came out, I said, man, I didn't even like Final Fantasy IV. If they redid 6 in this style, you know, with, you know, higher resolution 3D models, that would be awesome, because you don't have to totally change the game, but doing it's like what they did with the Resident Evil remake. It's an enhanced remake, but it's still the same game. You know, you don't necessarily have to add new characters, but, you know, throw a wrinkle or two into the combat system. I mean, imagine if they got, you know, this upgraded version of the soundtrack. That'd be fantastic. I don't know.
No, Steven, when you bring up something like the Resident Evil remake, then I totally see where your argument is coming from. I think that is probably the best remake ever made in terms of video game. That thing was incredible.
Well, that's what it's supposed to be. Because that game, and again, I think Final Fantasy IV did the same thing, where it plays on your expectations of, okay, you've played the original, you know what happens here, so we're throwing you a bone, and if you've never played it, you're just getting a solid experience.
I just have to go back to my grand thesis of when we started this podcast, so we're talking about, what, almost 3 years out from when we started. My grand thesis is that Square Enix can't really do anything right anymore. And there have been some blips on the radar here and there that people seem to like. I don't necessarily agree, but I got to acknowledge that some people like some of the things that they've been doing. But I just, this is like when I talked about wanting to see a Vagrant Story 2, and then I quickly said, no, I have a feeling that Ashley Riot would be on a motorcycle, and I would really be pissed off. I don't know if Square Enix can do it. I really don't.
You have a lot of people who left Square Enix. Like a lot of people who made those games aren't there anymore. Like Yasumi Matsuno isn't there anymore. You know, a lot of the people who made those kind of games that we hold in really high regard are off doing other things that are very similar to the stuff they used to do. Square Enix, you have a new generation of people making games. Now, on the other hand, I personally don't necessarily think they do a great job either, because I think they're very focused on style and flash now. And now they have this, with the Lightning Returns trailer, they have this kind of horrifying fusion of surface level, this has to look cool, and also we want to make it look like Western games that are selling like gangbusters, so that way we can make more money. And, you know, maybe that's not totally fair to them, but I like with Kingdom Hearts, like for example, with Dream Drop Distance, that game was very obviously designed to look insane, and then they're like, oh, that's right, we needed a story, and I think also some Disney stuff was part of this, right? Sora's bouncing off walls. It's crazy.
I truly think that the greatest issue with modern Japanese game development is that it's not stuff that's made for Japan anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean by that is go back 10 years, go back 15 years. And despite Japan's huge population differential from North America, you know, the United States has 300 million people. Japan has what, 50 million? No, does anyone know their numbers off the top of their head?
I don't keep those numbers in the back of my head.
Okay. I should know those numbers, but no, I don't.
While I'm talking, I will look that up. But despite that, you had, you know, million, double million, triple million sellers. Okay, there's 127 million people in Japan, so I was off by a fair chunk. So there's less than half the amount of people in Japan that there are in the United States. But those people were buying more video games. Fast forward to today. Well, Japan's still buying a lot of video games. You can see that with Monster Hunter. You can see that with Dragon Quest. You can see that with lots of other games. But the United States, our population is buying even more video games because it's become almost as ingrained in our culture as it has in theirs. So companies, and combine that with the fact that games are much more expensive to make now. You know, mm-hmm. the technology and the expectations are much higher. Well, Japan's buying fewer video games. United States is making more. You need to sell more to make it worthwhile. So the onus goes on making games for the United States market. And let's face it, the kind of role-playing games that we like that come from Japan were the kind that were made for Japan. And those don't exist anymore. At least not in the way that they used to.
I 100% agree with you, John. I mean, Resident Evil 6 was such a corporate, hey, look at all this Call of Duty money and all this multiplayer and this whiz-bang approach to game design. Let's take our franchise and let's do that, and we'll sell millions of copies. And you know, surprisingly,
and having,
that game, it sold very well. Right, it sold very well based on the name, but I think the backlash against that game was everybody wanted, you know, a traditional Resident Evil game. We just got done talking about the Resident Evil remake. I agree with John. I think where the Japanese game development is getting screwed up right now is they want desperately to make a game for the Western audience because the Western audience is where the money is. As we want to, let's transition into the Lightning Returns trailer. Let's transition to this. So, new trailer for Lightning Returns, the sequel to Final Fantasy 13-2, the sequel to Final Fantasy 13. Right off the bat, Steven was watching the trailer at when we were doing the pre-show warm-up, and he's like, is it Assassin's Creed now? And I think that the decision to have the way she looks now and the way
she's like Ezio.
The way she's moving around the environment, it is like you can't help but feel like they're trying to grab on to that Assassin's Creed aesthetic. And it's so, you know what it is to me? You guys know the long-running Family Guy jokes where they do something really, really awkward for like a minute and a half, and it starts really funny, and then it gets awkward, and then it gets obnoxious, and then it goes back to being funny again? That's where I feel like Final Fantasy 13 is right now, where like it started off, and it was like I was so angry at it, and I'm now back to being angry. I thought it was funny with Final Fantasy 13-2, but now I'm back to being angry. That trailer that they showed looked atrocious. It looked janky. The environment looked crappy. The way she's moving around. I'm sorry, Adam Jensen, where are you? Did anyone ask for this?
No. First of all, the one thing I took issue with was that the environments looked very just, I don't know, it looked like
they were just like boxes.
Yes!
Yeah, like soulless boxes. And I think I was watching it while you guys were talking about something and I wasn't talking. And I happened to notice when she had the ridiculous looking sunglasses on. And I'm like, what exactly? Like, she looks absurd. And I actually thought the combat looked a little more like Crisis Core. And I really liked Crisis Core. So I don't know. I'm going to leave my verdict out on the combat at least. But the running around and stuff, I was just like, what even is this anymore?
But
let's be completely honest. Both the Final Fantasy 13 and 13-2 had what looked to be like free roaming. You know, if you were to never have played either of those games and you see Lightning jumping around like she's crazy, you would assume that, you know, oh, this game, you mash buttons. When in fact, literally, you just walk up to a place where it's like, oh, you need to jump up to the next place. And she jumps.
You're right, John, because like I just watched the Spoonie Experiment just did the first episode in the Final Fantasy 13 analysis, and he showed something that I hadn't even connected the dots on before because I was in graduate school. I didn't have the time to watch a lot of TV. He showed the Final Fantasy 13 commercial that has the gameplay teaser that when they originally showed Final Fantasy 13 of Lightning flipping around with all the bars on the screen. That was their demonstration of what the white engine would look like. And they used it in the freaking trailer for Final Fantasy 13. It's blatant mismarketing. I'm just like, that is disgusting to me because that's not what the game looks like. And they're just, I just don't understand it.
Deep breaths.
I'm so angry with them right now. Like I've gone from being pissed to thinking it's funny to back to being pissed again. I just don't understand it. I don't think anybody was sitting here going, you know what Final Fantasy 13 needed? Jumping. That's what we needed. We needed bland environments and jumping.
That was the same thing they did with 10 and 10-2. They added like the kind of awkwardish jumping. And I mean, it looks awkward, but it's just a way of, you know, just to be devil's advocate here, because I'm not a huge fan of it either, but you know, it's just a way to expand the way you can explore the environment in a relatively, you know, JRPG.
I just don't understand how anybody could be. I shouldn't say that because that sounds way too harsh and it sounds like I'm being way too critical. But as a longtime Final Fantasy fan, like going through the sky, going through that art book and writing that piece for the website, like made me remember how much I used to love Final Fantasy and feeling like I was on an adventure and exploring. And now I just stare at it and I'm like, you know what? This isn't even for me anymore. Why?
We did an interview way back before Kingdoms of Amalur came out, and I think this was the one Dave did, And they were talking about the art design in Amalur, and they were saying that his name, the art director, was it Seth MacFarlane or Todd MacFarlane?
Yes, that's Todd MacFarlane. Seth MacFarlane said, of Family Guy.
Yeah, I don't get me started on him. He said, when you're designing this world and you're creating something, I want you to ask yourself, what is the function of this thing? Whatever it is it a soul catcher? Is it a, you know, is it a giant guillotine? He said, I don't want you to put something in this world just because it looks cool. Everything in your world should have a function, and you should be able to say, oh yeah, I drew that there because the people of this village use that. Or in this dungeon, they're using this to kill people, or, you know, something like that. And Square Enix doesn't do that anymore. They do, holy crap, that would look cool if there was a big crystal there and a bunch of planes crashed into it, and then you jumped on top of the planes fighting a boss battle, right? That's how they design stuff now. And I always call it soulless, and I that's what I think it is. And it's the same thing they do at Kingdom Hearts now. It's just, this is the stuff that we're just dumping into the game because it looks flashy and cool with no thought of what the implications are.
Derek?
I like flashy and cool when it has a function.
I agree. I completely agree.
But not, yeah, what you're saying. But I agree, though. Like, I think her costume design is that, like, we saw the picture of her costume, I think, a day or two before that trailer came out. And the first thing I thought was just, like, what are they doing? Like, they just made her costume as completely absurd and unrealistic as possible. And realism isn't what I look for in games in general. But I don't know, like, I saw her costume and I was like, okay, I'm getting a weird feeling about this. And then when you see in the trailer with the sunglasses and she says the line, you should know who I am, it was just like, really? You guys are trying so hard. Like, I already like that character. And you guys know that I like Lightning and you guys aren't super big fans of her. Like, I think she's a cool character. But it's like so over the top in your face. Like, you better like her because she's so cool.
The thing is, I think Lightning
worst
looks cool.
Birthday ever.
Ever.
I like that, Lightning.
No, I think she looked cool, and that was the only reason I really used her in 13, was because, okay, she fights cool. I like her. Personality-wise, she's like, you know, a damp towel, but I don't know.
Doesn't she get better later in the game? I heard she got better later in the game.
She follows the Cloud school of, I hate everybody, wait, never mind, I love everybody.
A little bit, but I think that I don't know. I'm not going to say that she's like more nuanced than Cloud necessarily, because
she doesn't have multiple personalities. General,
right? There's less character development in 13 than there are in other Final Fantasies, which is one of the bigger issues of the game. And unlike 12, where that doesn't have a lot of character development, but the atmosphere is incredible and makes up for it. But anyway, Lightning Returns. So, like, you know, I'm the one who likes Final Fantasy 13, and I maintain that. And I've said it before, I don't think it's the best game ever, but I do like it. And 13-2, I enjoyed its gameplay. I enjoyed the gameplay, and I loved the soundtrack in that game, and I enjoyed exploring. Like, I liked playing it. But when it came to the story, it was just like, what is going on? And so when I see Lightning Returns, I'm like, okay, so the story seems even more nonsensical, and the gameplay looks weird. Like, how am I supposed to feel about this?
I agree with you.
And Lightning being over the top, so... I'm going to play it. I guarantee I'm going to play it, and I'm probably going to like it, unless they completely ruin it and it's 100% broken. I'm probably going to enjoy that game. But the way that they're marketing it and presenting it is really confusing me.
No, yeah, I agree with you. I think, you know, I didn't hate 13-2. I didn't get to play it much yet, but I enjoyed the demo in terms of gameplay, and I heard the story was awful, and I said, you know what? I barely finished 13. I'm not really on board with the story here, whatever. And then, you know, 13-2, I don't have any... I mean, I guess it doesn't matter that I don't have any attachment to the story. I think they're trying to make Lightning into a more compelling character than they have made her. Like, if they had spent two games building up a character that was interesting as Yuri from Shadow Hearts, and they made a third game where, like, Yuri's back, I'd be like, hell yeah, Yuri's back. But I'm sitting here, it's like... Like, you didn't give me any reason to care about what happens to her, because the first game where she wasn't too bad, then the second game where they just dumped all the plot development out the window, and then we're like, yeah, time travel and some other stuff, and yes, whatever.
She was hardly even in the second one. They were like,
yeah,
she had a couple of scenes. Yeah, she looked awesome. I mean, I actually really, I loved her outfit in two.
No, she looked cool
like,
too.
Battle goddess thing. But then in 13-3, it's sort of like, it's an amalgam of her outfits in one and two. And they're presenting her as this, like, lone savior, dark brooding heroine that, and she's not really like that. I mean, I know that you don't think that she has a super strong personality, but she, because in 13 she starts off as like, you know, badass swordswoman, doesn't care, is totally a loner, and then she sort of opens up and she realizes that she made mistakes and she admits to that. Okay, sure. And then in 13.2, she has sort of a different image as like an infallible warrior goddess. And then in 13, in Lightning Returns, she's like, it's yet another shift in personality that I'm not really understanding. Like, why would she change again? And why would you market Lightning as like the focal point of this game and then have her be basically a different character, if that makes any sense?
No, I agree. That's what I said with 13.1. She had some development, not much, and I didn't think it was terribly compelling. But she cared about her sister, and that was sort of her drive as a character. And she improved from that. But it's like in 13.2, it's like, well, yeah, we're done with that, Lightning. And then it's like, okay, well, now we need her to be our next iconic character. So now she's somebody else, and it just feels like. They're called 13 because they all involve a character named Lightning and some vague references to the last game.
Okay. I'm past being angry. I just want to move on. Can we move on?
Yes. Hyperdimension Neptunia Victory has been announced for March.
100% more Moe.
Yeah, honestly, like, I have so much respect for Compile Heart and IS America here, simply because, they know exactly what they're doing. This is not some, let's do something crazy. Like, they know their market, and they're doing it for this very specific market. I have to respect them for it. The trailer literally says tons and tons of Moe.
Yep. Netgear is still going
to
be my waifu.
I had to ask John.
Wait, say that again?
I said I didn't know what that... I remember when you were putting the trailer up, we were talking about it, and I was like, what's Moe? And you explained it to me. I was like, oh, well, yeah, that is very bold. But, you have to respect, they're not trying to sell their game to people that won't buy their game, which sort of ties into what we've been upset about with... Rob's upset with Final Fantasy and Resident Evil. They're not trying to change their game to sell more copies. They're like, well, we know who's going to buy our game, and we're going to make this game for them.
Yep. So if you had interest in Neptunia 1 or 2, which, despite the fact that these stories are very clearly not meant for me, Neptunia 2 had actually a very nice, if unpolished, battle system. So I'm hoping that at the very least, Victory follows suit there, but... we'll see what happens. I'm saving that for last because I'm going to leave while Rob talks about it.
No.
The Secret World is subscription free now. So, both of EA's MMORPGs from this year are now free to play. Though, unlike the Old Republic, you still have to buy the game, but you just don't have to pay subscription for it. So it's kind of like Guild Wars.
I don't understand why they didn't adopt the same model for both of their games. Like,
So let's step back for a second and let's be clear with one thing. Star Wars: The Old Republic is an Electronic Arts game. BioWare is owned by EA. EA funded the game. It's an Electronic Arts game. The Secret World...
Funcom, right?
Yes, the Secret World is owned by Funcom. It's a Funcom brand. It's a Funcom game.
Okay.
But it was an EA partner's distribution.
Okay,
so
that's why you could have different business model. Okay.
Because it is still, at the core, a Funcom game. So, Dave's not here. I know Dave played it.
I played.
It's kind of weird, but it's got its market. Combat's not very good.
If they could just go rip the combat out, like, that was my thing. Like, it the combat in that game was such an afterthought. But I was so intrigued by like the having to look around the environment and like visit websites to solve puzzles, which I didn't even have a chance to get to because it was so front loaded with a freaking zombie apocalypse in a small northeastern town. I wanted to shoot myself. I'm just like, why? They had such a really cool idea, and they just, it's like they got to the development and then they were just like, you know what, we have to put MMO combat in it.
Yeah, it's kind of unfortunate because there have been several combat-free MMOs, and none of them have done well, but they have existed. And I think that's kind of... Secret World could have succeeded there.
Yeah, it was such a cool idea. Like, it's funny because I think if they had done some of the really cool things that Guild Wars 2 had done in terms of, like, making it very easy to communicate with people and making, like, the whole MMO experience a little bit friendlier and they just ripped the combat out, they would have had something really special. And I think they could have developed, like, a groundswell. It's kind of what I'm... They keep bringing up, like, every couple of months, somebody talks about the White Wolf MMO, the World of Darkness MMO. And I'm just like, you know, if that thing is just boring MMO combat, I don't care. I want it to be about, like, political intrigue and forming alliances. I don't know how you make that an effective MMO, but God, just do something interesting.
Honestly, the game that's most effectively done that, and it's not been political, well, in some ways, is EVE Online.
Right. Right.
Is EVE Online is set up in such a way where literally it's not that they're creating a story that's full of political intrigue, is that they've created a game system that makes political intrigue.
And it's awesome.
Yeah. Which they actually just they just tied in EVE Online's part of the compatibility between EVE Online and Dust 514 together, which that should be really cool when that's all said and done.
Yeah, that concept was I really thought it was neat when they announced that.
Moving on.
All right, Pokemon's Mystery Dungeon comes out on the 24th of March. So that might be a roguelike that Rob would like, because it's full of Pokemon's.
I like Pokemon.
Yeah, so it's the first Mystery Dungeon game to have 3D graphics. You can use the 3DS camera to scan the world around you. It's Mystery Dungeon. It's a roguelike that's got Pokemon characters in it.
It looks alright. You can play as an Oshawott, which is cool because he's like, you know, clearly he's the king of Pokemon at this point. So,
I don't know what you just said.
He's like a water weasel, something.
Yeah. Does that make sense now?
Is he the guy in the logo that's next to Pikachu? Like the little white.
Probably. He looks like a snowman mixed with an otter.
That's a really apt description, actually.
He's so cute. Snuggle. Awesome news. Also for 3DS is Soul Hackers is coming to the U.S.
Yes!
It will be out in spring. And it will be awesome.
Yes. Yep. Things.
I'm excited. It's between that and Entry in Odyssey 4, it's going to be a very dungeon-y quarter.
We might even get SFT 4 next year. I don't know, though. And hopefully Bravely Default.
Be a good year for Bravely Default.
I hope we get Bravely Default. I'm not certainly will, but I hope we do. It was originally a Saturn and PS1 game. This is the first time it's coming out in North America. So if you like Shin Megami Tensei games, congratulations. It's on its way. Also coming to 3DS is Unchained Blades, which is another dungeon crawler. That's gonna be out January 4th. I lost the date.
We have a guy that played that game on our staff.
January 3rd, yes, Derek reviewed it. He gave it a... Let me click on the link. He gave it an 80-something.
Yeah, it was like, I think he gave it like an 80, 82.
It has really good 82. Music, too.
It's an okay game. I'm surprised that it took that long for them to get it on 3DS. I know they had a lot of issues. They've been posting about it off and on, so I'm glad to see it's finally going to get, a chance to reach another audience. I don't think it's a terrible game, but it's definitely not good for beginners for dungeon crawlers. Yeah.
Well, what dungeon crawler is?
Did it come out on PSP first or 3DS? I know it came out on something, and now it's coming out on something else.
Yes, it came out originally on PSP, and then in January it's coming out for 3DS.
Okay, cool.
Oh, go ahead.
You're about to answer my question.
Oh, there will be no physical version of the game. It's going to be download only.
PSP.
Is it any different from the PSP version? Like, resolution different?
The resolution is different because of the resolution of the 3DS screen, but I don't think that there's anything different in regards to content.
It's just that the map is on one screen and the dungeon's on the other. And on the PSP, it was sort of like a toggleable overlay. But that's it, really.
All right. And last, and I'm actually going to be leaving just after I announce this because I have nothing to add. I have to go, and I have nothing to add to this conversation.
Dude. All right, whatever.
All right. Dark Souls 2. Goodbye.
So, yeah.
I've been playing a lot of Dark Souls lately. It's been real.
Wait. Let's back up a little bit. I really wish I had been watching the VGAs when they first showed the trailer, because unfortunately I went on to Kotaku and I let out the squeal of a lifetime when I saw Dark Souls 2 announced. So
right,
I did.
Right, you texted me and I was like, whatever.
Yeah,
like, I didn't even believe you.
And so I didn't even like. I wish I had gotten a chance to watch the trailer without knowing what it was, because it did look different. I mean, you can't really glean too much from a trailer. It sort of had the aesthetics here and there, but it did look a little bit different.
I don't know. That knight looked just like a Dark Souls knight.
No, the knight looked like a Dark Souls knight, and the dragon looked like a Dark Souls dragon. But then the Edge magazine cover story comes out, and everybody starts losing their mind. Miyazaki is not directing it. It's going to a new guy. He's still standing on as a supervisor while he works on another project from. Then the new director, Shibuya, said something about accessibility, and the internet exploded, and blah, 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 blah. Okay.
They're not making Skyrim.
This is not going to be Skyrim, all right? Everybody needs to back up for a second. First off, I am nervous, just like anybody else would be, for a new game. Because when you hear about a new director taking over, when you hear about new directions, there's going to be a little bit of nervousness. When I hear them say accessibility, I hear, okay.
I think of a tutorial saying, hello, this covenant will allow you to invade and kill people.
And a more straightforward approach to that. I actually think, I've been replaying a lot of Dark Souls as well, and I think the covenant system is inherently broken and doesn't work as well as they wanted it to. I think there's really cool ideas. And like the Gravelord covenant, for example, is a really cool idea of like just griefing people. But they don't work to their full potential. It's like they're a side thing that could have been like an integral part of the experience, and instead they just kind of, they're there to screw around with, but I want them to be a more integral part. So if they clear that up, that's a good idea.
I personally think they worked pretty well. It's just with the way the servers were set up, it was very hit or miss as to whether or not, because you're already competing with, all right, I have to make sure I'm in the right area. I have to make sure my soul is the right level to do this. I have to hope that someone either summons me or I can get or I can invade. And then it's like, oh, and also you have a 50-50 chance of just flat out failing to be summoned. And right. If you're on PC, it's 99% chance.
And now they've even gone a step further and they've said they're going back to dedicated servers, which is one of the reasons why, even though I don't like Demon's Souls as much as Dark Souls, Demon's Souls is much more friendly in terms of summoning people. It was so Absolutely. Much easier in that game. So let's hope that they figure out the technical problems there. Miyazaki also said that he wants this game to be released when it's finished. I think he was hinting at the fact that they were kind of pushed to put Dark Souls out a little too soon. I don't even think this game's coming out next year. I think it's going to be early 2014, so we're talking potentially after a new console launch. But
also keep in mind that they've announced a PC version from the get-go this time.
Right. They've already said they've only got 25% of this game done. I think it's still very early. It just came out on Kotaku this week that it's a brand new engine, so I'm sure they were working on the engine for far longer in order to get the game up and running. I'm really excited to see where they go. I think that the shell of Dark Souls, it sounds like they want to keep the exploration, they want to keep the difficulty. Those
combat.
Are the core. Yeah, the combat. They want to keep the core tenets. If they want to try some new stuff to keep it fresh, I'm okay with this. When we first talked about Dark Souls, I said, because Zach was asking me, like, do you want a new one of these every 2 years? And I said, actually, I don't. Because there's something really special about this game, and if they're going to make a sequel to it, I want them to do some new stuff. Don't just release, you know, Gears of War 2, the Dark Souls edition, or whatever. I want to see advancement. I want to see some new stuff added to it to make it a proper sequel. And if they can do that, fine. I don't think we don't even know enough about this damn game. We haven't even seen an in-game screenshot yet.
And one thing you have to keep in mind, too, is that Dark Souls changed a lot of stuff from Demon's Souls, and it was better. You know, yeah. Some people argue that there are a lot of people, especially, you know, hardcore people on message boards that are like, no, Demon's Souls is far here. They've destroyed this or that. And, you know, that's an opinion. That's fine. You know, I can appreciate that because Demon's Souls is a great game, but I don't mind seeing some stuff change. Like, Pyromancy was new in Dark Souls. I didn't know what it was, but then all of a sudden, like, oh, this is cool. And, you know, I have no problem with something popping up on screen going, hey, don't go to the graveyard because you'll get killed instantaneously. You know, yeah. I want them to strike a balance and keep some of that, you know, that mystery there of, oh, I like the thing with Dark Souls is that my brother's been playing it a lot, and as he keeps saying, something crazy happens, and he goes, well, I didn't think that could happen, but then I remembered it's Dark Souls, so I don't know what can happen. And that's sort of what they need to keep, is that sense of, like, enigmatic, there's so much here you may not know anything about, and the only way to find out is to just go on and see what happens. And as long as they keep that and, you know, the core, like, the combat and the really, really fantastic world design, I think I'll be okay.
Yeah, I mean, so far the art, the pieces of art that they've released, I mean, it looks like Dark Souls.
So cool.
It looks like Dark Souls.
The monster designs are awesome, dude.
I mean, I'm worried, but I'm worried in a positive way. I'm excited. I want to see what they do. I don't see them butchering it. I do worry, though, because From Software does kind of have a tendency to put out lots and lots of sequels, so that does make me a little nervous. I wouldn't be surprised if Miyazaki's other project right now was Demon's Souls 2. It really wouldn't surprise... Or if it was even Dark Souls 3 on a next-generation console, it really wouldn't surprise me if that's what they were doing. I don't want to see...
As long as there's a space, I'm okay with that.
Well, as long as there's space and I want advancement. I don't want just... Playing through the Artorias DLC, it showed me two things. One, the Artorias fight really showed me what the final boss fight of Dark Souls should have been. Where
my brother fought Artorias yesterday, and I was sitting there going, man, this fight is awesome.
That is an awesome, awesome fight. And meanwhile, Lord Gwyn is... I was able to actually beat Lord Gwyn with a great shield, which I had never done before. So they definitely toned him down a little bit, but it showed me...
I never thought... was broken, though. He was tough, but the thing is that
you didn't play it when it first came out, dude.
Yeah,
Before the first patch, that first week, he would not stop. He was the freaking Terminator. He literally would not stop. He just kept swinging at you. There was no way to even, like, it was ridiculous. Like, it was just like he would pin you and you're dead. Game over. It was then they
Real
knocked
Dark
him
Souls
down
starts now.
Yeah, then they knocked him down a little bit, but like playing through the Artorias DLC showed me that I don't just want new environments, I do want some new stuff. I do want like the Covenant thing to work a little bit more. I want it to be easier for me to like summon somebody. Right now, trying to summon somebody on PS3, at least where I am with my peer-to-peer service, is terrible. It is just terrible. I'm getting invaded more than I'm seeing summon signs. It sucks.
I'm actually watching my brother play Artorias right now, and I'm not saying that there isn't a problem with the connection issues, because I know there are from personal experience, but it's not broken. I mean, he's invading people, he's getting invaded, he's has people join him, you know.
It's very hit and miss without dedicated servers, though.
Oh no, very absolutely. Hit and miss. That's the thing, is people are already panicking, and I'm like, they've already made at least one good decision.
Yeah.
And it's not just the director that made that game. You know, he directed it, yes, but there were the team that made the game does the bulk of the programming and the design and stuff. So, same people.
Yeah.
Just because you put a different guy at the top doesn't mean it's going to be broken and destroy everything you've ever known and loved about Dark Souls.
Yeah. I mean, we could talk about this all day, but my big thing is that everybody just needs to relax. I think the game's big reveal is going to be at E3 or maybe a little bit before. I mean,
God, I hope it's at E3.
I think it's going to be at E3, Steven, and you will be calling me while you play it. I want you to have a headset in, and yes, we are talking about it. Like, I'm so excited to see where they go. I think it's great that this game that is kind of a cult classic right now, we get another one. It's a really good idea. I thought the VGAs knocked it out of the park with a reveal like that. I was like, after all the crap that they had gone through with like the teabagging last year, I thought that was a massive win. I was just
they did a surprisingly good job doing things that weren't stupid this year. Like, they gave awards to games that deserved awards, not just games that had really popular publishers.
Let's be honest here, that the giving Walking Dead the game of the year was a hipster choice. That it was.
Walking Dead. Everybody's giving it to The Walking Dead.
Well, that and XCOM. And I'm just
They gave a nod to Journey, too, though. That's not necessarily a very popular game. It's a really good one. I mean, from everything I've heard, you know, I'm actually trying to play it soon. But,
Steven, we both know it's not the game of the year. The game of the year was Dishonored.
Dark Souls, prepare to die. Oh, yeah, Dishonored.
Derek, any thoughts on Dark Souls 2? Are you excited to die? Oh, for God's sake.
Derek, play Dark Souls again. Don't go to the graveyard. The graveyard is like late.
All right. Okay, buy for me on Steam. I'll play it.
Dude, you have it on PS3.
No, I don't.
I thought you did.
No, I like when I worked at GameStop, which I don't anymore. Haha.
Oh, you played one of the versions?
I checked it out, yeah. I just did, like, the employee checkout thing.
Actually, at this point, I don't think there's any reason to play the console version if you have access to the PC version, because the mod that makes it look better makes it look freaking fantastic, and you get your solid frame rate and the ability to take screenshots, which is great, because I can be vain. So while I'm fighting a boss that can kill me in one hit, I can stop and try to pose and take a picture of myself so I look cool.
All right. I have a nice PC, so yeah, sure, if you want to buy that for me, go right ahead, and I'll try it.
Okay. So yeah, Dark Souls 2, let's see where they go with it. We got lots of games coming up. As we bring this...
I apologize to John in advance for when it comes out, and we don't talk about anything else.
Yeah, it's going to be bad. So with the end of episode 54, just wanted to let everybody know that we are planning on doing a 2012 retrospective podcast to open up the new year. We're going to have lots and lots to talk about. I'm sure we'll complain about Mass Effect 3 again. We just have I want that to be like a big kind of fun year, and we're going to do our predictions for next year. I was going to predict Dark Souls 2 was announced, so crap.
Oh, not anymore.
Well, there we go. So I got to come up with a new prediction, but yeah, stay
Hopefully
tuned.
Hopefully Dishonored 2 gets announced, because that would be lovely.
I think it might be a little early for that, but whatever.
Nope.
So yeah, stay tuned, look forward to that. Make sure to give us reviews on iTunes, send us questions. We are collecting some for hopefully another listener feedback in the future. And until then,
why you mad, bro, is not an appropriate question.
Shut up. Until then, we will talk to you guys later.